around Almawasi refugee camp. Why would he not publicly address that?
As of May this year, more than 70% of Britons want to see an end to the genocide in Gaza, and many back a pause in arms sales to Israel. There have been 9 months of protests demanding the UK government stop its complicity in genocide. That demand has gone unheeded so far. The question now is, how long can the new government ignore it? Saeed Purizam, London.
Once again, we are in Al-Nusayrat refugee camp, covering another horrifying massacre that was committed over the last night against Hamad family. We have Hamad family house that was completely destroyed after the Israeli warplanes targeted the house over the heads of the family, over the heads of the people who were taking shelter inside that house. 11 Palestinian civilians, including 5 children, were slaughtered in this house while they were sleeping. It is another massacre added to the ongoing and the non-stop attacks against the central area of Gaza Strip generally and Al-Nusayrat refugee camp particularly. Let's find out more details about what happened here over the last night, having this interview with this eyewitness.
The women were sitting over here. All of a sudden, an Israeli missile hit the place. The children were playing. We found their bodies torn into pieces. They were all civilians. 5 children and 3 women were killed without any reason. I am speechless. All the Gaza Strip is sentenced to death.
The current situation, whenever there is any kind of any attacks against the horizontal buildings, the Israeli occupation forces leave massive destruction and wide-scale damage and ruin in those horizontal buildings. In all areas of Gaza Strip, they are still insisting on targeting and destroying. Let's have another eyewitness in order to have more details about what happened in this massacre over the last night.
We are not affiliated with any faction. We're all civilians. I lost my 2 sons, my uncles and my cousins. They were turned into pieces. What was their crime? I was preparing the milk for my children when they were killed before they could even drink it. The missile targeted them directly.
This is the real manifestation of the ongoing Israeli brutality against the Palestinian people. Whenever there is any kind of any attack against the Palestinian residential buildings and areas, we have this kind of this misery. And the Palestinian people are completely devastated with these ongoing atrocities being committed day and night against the Palestinian people. Abu Musabbih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
Syrian citizens flocked to the polls on Monday to participate in elections for the 4th legislature following the 2012 constitutional amendments. Voting stations opened at 7 a.m. and remained open until 7 p.m. President Assad and senior Syrian figures participated in this election, emphasizing their commitment to taking responsibility for the country's future.
The parliamentary elections, along with the presidential and local council elections, were organized smoothly and on time, demonstrating that we are a nation governed by institutions. Syria is entering a new phase of openness, requiring citizens to play a role in shaping the country's policies while moving forward. We are hopeful that the new parliament will fulfill its responsibilities.
A total of 1,516 candidates competed for the 250 seats in the Syrian parliament. Citizens viewed these elections as an opportunity to shape the country's future by electing representatives who would address their needs and aspirations.
We opened at 7 in the morning with representatives of all candidates present to ensure transparency. Voter turnout has been good so far, and we expect it to increase throughout the day. We are providing all necessary facilities to citizens in collaboration with relevant authorities.
With high hopes for their country's future, Syrians demonstrated a strong sense of responsibility through widespread participation, signifying a positive step towards recovery in the Arab nation.
Let's hope that our elected representatives fulfill the promises outlined in our electoral programs and help our country overcome the economic challenges. The reconstruction of Syria is a top priority for all Syrians.
Participating in these elections is a duty regarding my country. I am voting for those who will work for the betterment of the people's conditions and fulfill our aspirations, particularly in improving the economic situation. I hope the candidate who truly serves the country's best interests wins.
These elections took place amidst a positive atmosphere fueled by the gradual opening that Syria is experiencing in various areas, paving the way for a return to normalcy. Experts believe the next parliament will play a significant role in shaping the country's future and setting its course for the next phase. Syrians are not only exercising their national rights and duty by voting in these elections, they are also showing the entire world that they can decide their fate and make a difference with their votes through democratic means. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Rights campaigners are convinced that Israel is committing genocide and ethnic cleansing against Palestinians, actions blatantly supported by the United States and many EU nations. The death toll in Gaza continues to soar. People are starving and deprived of the most basic health care.
It's about an ideology, a Zionist ideology that was imported from Europe into our country, our own country of Palestine. And that ideology, its aim, I believe, in my own personal opinion, and it's been proven and it's been shown the case that they are trying to eliminate the Palestinian people and the Palestinian culture and history from all of the land of Palestine.
On Monday, after he met his Jordanian counterparts in Brussels, the EU's top diplomat, Joseph Borrell, again spoke out about the situation facing Palestinians.
I want to express my utter dismay over the unbearable climbing human cost and wide-scale destruction caused in Gaza by this conflict.
That's just the problem for EU policy critics. Instead of empty words, they are demanding economic sanctions and an arms embargo to be placed on the Israeli government. Additionally, the EU has been called upon to clarify its new plans to address the humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
We are looking at the possibility of facilitating medical evacuations jointly with member states and the WHO from the Gaza Strip to third or neighboring countries in the region.
That response has been described as pitiful by those desperate to see adequate international support for dying Palestinians.
Europe stands with Israel.
European Commission boss Ursula von der Leyen set the tone for the EU when she travelled to Israel last October at the launch of Netanyahu's latest massacre. The EU's response, or lack thereof, to the atrocities has seriously undermined the bloc's credibility in the eyes of many. The question is being asked, is there literally no limit to what Israel can do before it faces consequences from the West? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
It's been 9 years since the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, also known as the Iran deal, was signed between Iran and several world powers in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The signatories to the 2015 landmark agreement were China, France, Germany, Russia, and the United Kingdom, apart from Iran and the United States. Under the agreement, the U.S. and the EU agreed to remove anti-Iran sanctions imposed over the years in exchange for Iran limiting its uranium enrichment and reducing its existing stockpile. The deal was eventually violated by the U.S. during the administration of President Donald Trump, who pulled out his country from the deal. That despite, Iran fully adhered to its part of the obligation under the JCPOA. Europeans also failed to salvage the accord by not complying to the accord.
The JCPOA had its pluses and its minuses. The biggest problem was that it was not protected. In other words, there were no real mechanisms to protect the deal if the Americans or the Europeans violated the agreement. And so when Obama began violating the deal, when he began to increase the sanctions, and of course the Europeans always obey the United States, there was no punishment. They paid no price for these violations. And then, of course, when Trump ultimately tore up the deal, it came at no political or economic cost for the United States.
The JCPOA was the result of 20 months marathon negotiations between the diplomats from Iran, the U.S., European countries, as well as China and Russia. These negotiations first led to the interim joint plan of action, concluded in 2013 in Geneva, then a framework agreement concluded in April 2015 in Lausanne, and finally, on July 14, 2015 in Vienna, it was announced that the final agreement has been clinched.
If you think about the guarantee of the JCPOA, it is important to notice that there is no way in international relations that finally force them states to obey a regulation or a deal or a treaty among them. And that is why every party can withdraw illegally but practically from a deal, and that is why JCPOA was not the only treaty or was not the only deal that United States withdrew during Trump era and other times. Trump withdrew from Paris Agreement, from NAFTA, from the deal with Russia, from the tariff deal with China, and some others, many others.
Over the next 2 years following the signing of the deal, while Iran fully complied with the terms of the agreement, the unreliability of Americans was clear as they looked for pretexts to scale back their commitments. However, with Trump coming to the White House, as known for his close affiliation with the Israeli regime, the stage was set for nixing the accord. On May 8, 2018, Trump issued an executive order announcing that he was withdrawing the U.S. from the JCPOA. Trump's unilateral move virtually led to the collapse of the implementation of key provisions of the JCPOA, as the two main parties to the agreement were Iran and the U.S. Despite the U.S.'s withdrawal, Iran decided to remain a signatory to the agreement with the remaining parties, but with implementation of reciprocal measures in line with its parliamentary law. Fateh Masumi, Tehran. Muharram is the first month on the Islamic calendar. Every year during this month, mourners take to the streets and gather in mosques and other religious places to take part in different ceremonies for the martyrdom anniversary of the third Shia Imam. The mourning rituals reach their peak on Ashura, the 10th day of Muharram, when Imam Hussein and his 72 companions were martyred in the Battle of Karbala in Iraq in the 7th century. On the first Friday of Muharram, similar ceremonies are held in dozens of countries across the globe to honor the youngest martyr of Karbala. Six-month-old Hazrat Ali Asghar was martyred on the day of Ashura. This year, Iranians marked the occasion in various cities and towns across the country. One of those ceremonies was held in the capital, Tehran, with thousands of mothers and their toddlers in attendance.
We are here for the innocence of those martyred in Karbala on the day of Ashura, especially the children like Ali Asghar. We are waiting for the arrival of Imam Zaman and we remain loyal to our leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. We are upset about the children of Gaza as they are killed by the Zionist regime. We wish the mothers in Gaza can also hold their children safely and freely in their arms without any fear of losing them.
Muharram and Karbala are the symbol of the perennial struggle between truth and falsehood, just and unjust, the relevance and significance of Imam Hussein's epic uprising against the then corrupt and despotic ruler in the plains of Karbala go beyond the boundaries of time and space. These annual commemorations amount to the reaffirmation of people's pledge of allegiance to the principles that the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, fought for.
As a mother, I'm here on this important day because Hazrat Ali Asghar, who was only 6 months old, was martyred by those who are very similar to Zionist regime killing innocent children in Gaza today. It's very heartbreaking. So all of these mothers here are praying for justice.
The movement, which has gripped the hearts and minds of people throughout history, is unfolding even today in Palestine, where Muslim men and women and children are killed and houses are flattened on a daily basis. What's unfolding in Palestine today is reminiscent of what took place 1,400 years ago, an apartheid regime which has occupied people's land, confiscated their properties, and driven them out of their homes, is today's version of the then tyrant empire at the time of the Battle of Karbala.
This year's mourners expressed their support for the oppressed Palestinians during Muharram ceremonies. Speaking up against injustice and oppression is the message of the Battle of Karbala and the legacy of Imam Hussein and Sayyida Zainab, peace be upon them. Fatah Masumi, Tehran.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
On Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me, in full, in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Israeli far-right minister, Itamar Ben-Gavir, has broken into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This despicable act, however, was accompanied by statements that he made on the Israeli captives, which was insightful. He said that he hopes the captives would return without the PM Netanyahu giving in to agreeing to a ceasefire plan. This points to how the regime was never sincere in wanting to agree to a ceasefire in the first place. Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at different aspects of this genocidal onslaught, such as U.S. banned weapons, Israeli shortage of tanks and ammunition, Israeli regime store closures, the state of its military skirmishes with Hezbollah in the north, and the regime passing a law opposing a Palestinian state. First, let me introduce our guests. Elijah Magner, journalist and political analyst, joins us from Brussels. Also joining us is Mick Napier, co-founder of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who joins us from Glasgow, UK. Gentlemen, welcome. I'll start with you, Elijah Magner. It's good to see you. We're looking at this visit by Ben-Gavir. He went there to pray for the return of Israeli captives from Gaza, is one of the things that he said. Now, his visit, if you want to call it, which many don't call it that, they even go as far as calling it a desecration, is A, to Judaize the norm for that, which is supposed to be for Muslims only, but B, what he said about the captives, where he said he wanted to make sure that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu does not give in to pressure on signing this prisoner swap deal, as he called it. Does that mean, do you think, that they are not sincere overall when it comes to the ceasefire agreement?
Thank you for having me. Israel has never been sincere under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu about respecting any deal with the Palestinian resistance to end this war. I remember, and we all remember, in May when Hamas agreed upon the ceasefire deal presented by the Israelis and the Americans, and immediately the response came from Benjamin Netanyahu occupying Rafah. And then after that, President Joe Biden presented another plan. He called it, this is an Israeli plan. And Hamas never disagreed. On the contrary, it has agreed on the main line of the plan, and then Benjamin Netanyahu rejected it. And then we hear from Benjamin Netanyahu very clearly at the Knesset yesterday, saying the military pressure is forcing Hamas to give more concession than we imagined before. So what he's talking about is he's talking about the more killing of the civilians, children and women mainly, destroying the tents and assassinating more, trying to assassinate more militants or civilians in the street. And because of Hamas is feeling for the Palestinian population and wanting to show the population that actually it is not its position that is preventing a ceasefire. But every time we agreed on something, it is Netanyahu who is doubling down and thinking that this is a position of weakness when the resistance has not shown any weakness throughout the 9 months of war and did never raise a white flag. Then now it is clear that the more they agree on any ceasefire, Benjamin Netanyahu is going to reject it and continue the war, because he said the objectives are to defeat Hamas and to kill every single militant, no matter what level of leadership he has, even if it is simple militant, and continue the war and remain in Gaza, which is totally against any agreement presented by the Israelis or the Americans. So what Ben-Gvir is saying today is exactly the reflection of what Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been doing in the last 9 months. And the last thing they want is to exchange all the captives with the Palestinian resistance, because they don't care about them. They just want to continue the war, continue destruction of Gaza, and continue killing civilians because they are unaccountable.
Well, let's perhaps get an idea from you, Mick Napier, about what is really going on when it comes to the situation on the ground there. I mean, Israel may be thinking, or maybe is saying, that it is, as our guest there said, Hamas is giving up concessions that it never thought that they would give before. But then we hear reports of how there's shortages of tanks, that they've been destroyed by the Hamas resistance fighters and other resistance groups in the Gaza Strip. There's a shortage of ammunition. And we're also hearing that there's a shortage of regime forces, where the first batch of draft orders have gone out to the, what are they called, the Haredim, and the conscription notices have gone out for these ultra-Orthodox men for the first time, 1,000 of them, and also for female Israeli regime forces. So what is the deal? Can you make out what footing the Israeli regime is at when it comes militarily?
Yes, I don't think there's too much new in terms of Israeli long-term military practice. The extreme may be new. But Israel has long had what its high command calls, and which is openly discussed in Israel, the Dahiya Doctrine, named after a southern suburb of Beirut. And the Dahiya Doctrine basically is that if anyone resists the Israeli military machine, they will exact massive civilian casualties and destroy the basic necessities of life, water, electricity, sewage, and so on. This isn't a conspiracy theory. The Dahiya Doctrine is a doctrine. It's been openly discussed and adopted by the Israeli military. And more importantly, we see it being carried out in Gaza, where unable to defeat the fighters, as far as we can tell, unable to defeat the fighters, as they were unable to defeat Lebanese fighters, Lebanese resistance in 2006, they respond by trying to kill a very, very large number of civilians. And, you know, it's not even particularly Israeli. It's the whole history of European colonialism worldwide has been to exact a terrible price for resistance by killing very, very large numbers of the colonized population. So Israel fits into that tradition and sees itself as fitting into that tradition, and its behavior in Gaza is simply an extension of that. And in terms of the Israeli captives who have been held by the Palestinian resistance since October, the Israelis will always sacrifice Jews when it comes to a clash between their interests and the core interests of the Israeli state. The Israeli state, if necessary, will sacrifice the interests of Jews. And this has been the case even before the birth of the state. The Zionist movement would ally and support people who were slaughtering Jews because it facilitated the setting up of the state. And we see that in 1917, we see it in 1944 in Hungary, and we've seen it since then, that in a choice between representing the interests of real Jews living in countries around the world or the Israeli state will easily sacrifice the interests of Jews. So that the Israeli captives, I think the Palestinian resistance may have thought that the Israelis would have to negotiate much more than they've been ready to do. But it seems they're quite ready to see sacrifice the captives in the interests of defeating Hamas. They're no longer closer to that, and they will continue and are continuing daily to exact a massive price in the killing of civilians. But it ain't new. It's part of a long Israeli tradition, and that itself is part of a much wider tradition of European colonialism.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's move on to another, news that has now been passed in the Israeli parliament to Elijah Magnier, and that's about how they have passed, I guess, a bill opposing a Palestinian state. They have actually branded it as an existential threat. And this comes ahead of a visit by the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to Washington. Why do you think they have passed the bill to that effect? Is it because they are setting the grounds, not they haven't before, but setting the grounds to go into fast, maybe speed, into taking over the entire occupied land?
I think that was one of the best news I ever heard since 1948 regarding Palestine, because it puts an end to the hypocrisy of the Americans and the Israelis calling for a potential two-state solution when this has never been on the table. The 1977 Likud Party manifest states exactly that the presence of any Palestinian on the Israeli land is a threat to the Israeli national security, which is exactly in its exact words that the Knesset law has passed today. So the Israelis have been very honest about it, and they've been very honest in saying we don't want any Palestinian to live on the land that we have occupied and conquered. And then all the Oslo agreement and all this charade that went on in 1993, Oslo 1, 1995, Oslo 2, it's crumbled in 1999 when no Palestinian state was given to the Palestinian according to the agreement. And then we hear about the Abraham Accord and then reconciliation and the recognition of the Israeli as a nation and as a state when it is an apartheid regime that has occupied a land that doesn't belong to the Israeli Zionists. And then we see the Americans pushing for a two-state solution. And then before the visit, just a few days before the visit, Benjamin Netanyahu goes to the Knesset. 68 members of the Knesset agreed, including Benny Gantz. And the Yair Lapid in the opposition left because he didn't want to show that he also supported. Everybody in Israel refuses a two-state solution. It is time for all the people in the Middle East and around the world, either they want to do something about it, which is not recognize Israel as a state and recognize Israel as an apartheid regime that has stolen the state, a state of the Palestinians and then rejected it, or they close their eyes as they have done, as the Americans have done twice at the United Nations, vetoing the recognition of Palestine as a state. And this puts also an end to all the Palestinians who think that the Americans are good partners for peace, and then there is a possibility to have a peace with the Israelis. And what they have done today, it, they have confirmed the choice of the Palestinian resistance that talking to the Israelis is a waste of time. And the Israelis, what they want to do, and they are saying it without lying, that after Gaza, they're going to turn their guns to the West Bank, where there is a Palestinian authority that's still telling the Palestinians that they believe one day they're going to have a state. Well, today, the Israelis are saying, no, you will not have an inch of your own territory. So this, I think, is a good lesson for the Palestinians and for all the resistance forces in the Middle East to understand that resisting Israel was, they were on the right path, they were on the right course, and now it is time for all those Palestinians who think that a peace with Israel is possible one day, then it is time for them to understand that only by armed resistance they can recover their territory. And that is the biggest favor the Knesset has rendered to the Palestinian cause today.
Do you agree with that, Mick Napier?
Well, I think illusions are very dangerous. Real illusions, if you're just walking about and you suffer from illusions, it's a dangerous condition. And the illusion that Israel would ever concede one square inch of Palestinian land to be a Palestinian state is fanciful. It's belied in several different ways. One, everything the Israelis say I think Ariel Sharon, who preceded Ben-Gavir in violating the Al-Aqsa Mosque so many years ago, Ariel Sharon is quoted in the Israeli Parliament, sorry, in the Israeli Cabinet, by a colleague, Abraham Berg, as saying the only good Arab is a dead Arab. He wasn't being original. That quote's lifted from the American West, but it's applied to Israel as well. That's always been the view of a huge chunk of the Zionist movement, that the only good Arab is an Arab who's been expelled or been killed or been reduced to massively inferior status. So their own words tell you, if anyone wants to listen, that the Palestinians have no partner for peace at all. They never had. Some of the Zionists use soft words, but Ben-Gavir is being strikingly honest, and he's embarrassing the other Zionists who believe the same as him, but they wish to approach the expulsion of Palestinians and the slaughter in a slower scale than Ben-Gavir does. But the second way in which the thing is shown to be nonsensical is the behaviour of the Israelis. In 1948, they were given just over half. They took almost 80% of Palestine. They seized the rest in 1967. They've been building settlements ever since and making it very clear. And a couple of years ago, Netanyahu passed, for those who really did not want to face the truth, he passed the Israeli Nation State Law, which said that only Jews, and that can mean Jews living in my city here in Glasgow or Jews in Australia, but only Jews have any political rights, have political rights to self-determination in Palestine. And Palestinians living there, citizens of Israel or otherwise, do not enjoy those rights. So it was very clearly an apartheid declaration of intent or description of reality, and was embarrassing for Western governments. But I think it seems almost impossible for them to continue on this tightrope. But even though the Israelis are now saying yet again that there's no possibility of a Palestinian state as long as Israel exists, it's difficult to see Western governments giving up this fantasy, because the talk of a two-state solution is an alibi for doing nothing to support the Palestinians while funneling weapons, political, economic support to Israel. And the third thing, the third way that gives a lie to it, is that, you know, in the history of settler colonialism like Israel, in the beginning, the settlers are weak and feeble, and they rely utterly on the colonial power, the imperial power, to support them against the native people, who could easily kick them out. But as they become stronger, they develop the idea, and this is true in America in 1776, it's true in Argentina, it's true in many countries, as the settlers become stronger, they think they can dispense with imperial protection. So they dispensed with Britain in 1948, and it may be that they think, not that they can dispense with American protection, but I think they think that their hold on American politics is so tight that whatever they do, there will still be an airlift of weapons and dollars from Washington to Tel Aviv. And you know, it's worth saying in passing that the current situation is a massive defeat for the idea of Zionism, because Zionism sold itself to European powers and then to America as an attack dog, as a powerful state in the region that could intimidate all its natives and be an asset. But now it seems that it cannot fight even the Gaza resistance, with nowhere to retreat to, without an airlift of American bombs and weapons and so on. So far from being an asset, it seems that in order for Israel to survive, it cannot fight a war even against Hamas, with its massive disadvantages, without billions from America and an airlift of weapons. So it seems that Zionism has failed, and failed in the eyes of those who created it, but it will exact a terrible cost. And actually, it should be said in passing, they not only insist on every square inch of Palestine, but many of them have appetites further east. And there's open discussion in the Israeli political system, not just no longer need the services of the Palestinian Authority, but also perhaps to to remove the Jordanian monarchy because it no longer serves its purpose either. So it seems that they think they've reached the stage. I think they may be wrong. They think they've reached the stage where they can pretty much do what they want. And I think, you know, they keep on spitting in the eye of the American government, which seems very, very bizarre. But I think they can do it because of their hold on Congress.
Well, what are we looking at then when it comes to the Americans and when it comes to Europeans, Elijah Magner? Are we looking now at a different approach that they're going to have towards Israel? At this point, the Knesset has passed this. What about peace negotiations or any of that? Is that out the window?
Well, it has always been out of the window, because if we even look at the Oslo Agreement per se, it has never given the Palestinians the right to have access to air, sea, and land without going through the Israeli control. Moreover, all the money that comes to the Palestinians, it has to go through the Israeli government. The taxes that the Palestinians are paying, they have to go through the Israeli government. And this is where the finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, is all the time cutting pieces of all this money. We're talking about more than $6 billion in 10 years because the Israelis have the control and the Palestinians have nothing. So advocating for a fake two-state solution was only kind of morphine to give to the Palestinians and to give the choice of for the Palestinians who reject the peace with Israel. It's showing them a model in the West Bank that has never worked. And the Europeans and the Americans, in particular the Democrats, who used to be known for advocating for two-state solutions, today they receive a big hit on their head because Benjamin Netanyahu is saying all the masks are dropped and it is the end of hypocrisy. We don't want Palestinians ever, not one Palestinian, because that represents a danger to the national security of Israel. Now, for that, Netanyahu, because he is unaccountable, he has killed and wounded more than 130,000 Palestinians in 9 months. Because he is unaccountable, the West, that are allies with Israel and the Americans, have not managed to put pressure on Israel, either because they don't want or they can't. Therefore, their opinion doesn't count. Today, Netanyahu is saying, regardless of the decision that some European countries have taken in recognizing Palestine as a state, how that can be translated on the ground. Here in Israel, the Palestinians will have no right to exist. And that is final for Benjamin Netanyahu. So the Europeans are spineless. They execute the American policy. America is walking along the Israelis. They're telling the world one thing, and then they use the veto at the United Nations for any decision that is in favor of two Palestinian states. President Mahmoud Abbas, because the Americans are happy with him, it means that he is not the right person to represent the Palestinians, because anyone that is supported by the Americans is supported by the Israelis, which means it is counterproductive for the interest of the Palestinians. And that has been translated. This is not an opinion. Today, the Knesset said no to the Palestinian state. It did not trigger any reaction from the Americans, apart from saying, well, this is very worrying. And of course, this is something that we need to look at carefully. They never said we stand against Israel. They never said we're going to go to the United Nations and recognize Palestine as a state. On the contrary, they're still finding alibi and excuses for Netanyahu, who is challenging America and who is blowing up what remains of the Abraham Accord, because everybody was waiting for Saudi Arabia to join. And Saudi Arabia said, with two-state solutions, I will join in. But it doesn't mean Saudi Arabia did not maintain good relationship with the Israelis and allow Israeli visit to the Saudi territory. So in this case today, Netanyahu is putting in a corner those who did not yet normalize with Israel, and we're talking about Saudi Arabia in the first place, And he's saying you will normalize with or without a Palestinian state because there will not be a Palestinian state here.
Thank you so much for that. Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Mick Napier, co-founder, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. When we cover Tahweh and the team, it's goodbye.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The head of Amnesty International says the Zionist regime's unprecedented violence in Gaza has proven international law to be, frankly, useless. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, the head of Amnesty International says that Israel's unprecedented violence in Gaza has proven international law to be frankly useless. Amnesty's Secretary General Agnes Callamard told Al Jazeera, we are really as close to the abyss as we have ever been. Callamard's comments feature in a new film titled The Night Won't End, an uncompromising examination of the Zionist regime war crimes during the genocide in Gaza. The new documentary is part of the Qatar-based channel's Fault Line series. The film examines the genocide through the lens of four Palestinian families in Gaza and the massacres the Zionist regime has carried out against them. You can watch the full film in the video. One of the families is that of Hind Rajab, the 6-year-old Palestinian girl murdered by Israeli regime troops in January while she was on the phone to the Palestine Red Crescent Society desperately calling for help. Trapped in a car surrounded by the bodies of her dead family, Hend was the sole survivor of an Israeli regime massacre. The family were fleeing their Gaza City home. The film includes harrowing audio of that phone call, as well as interviews with Hend's mother and Red Crescent workers, as it details the doomed efforts to save the girl while she was pinned down in the car. After detailed coordination with Israeli occupation authorities, they sent paramedics to evacuate the surviving girl. Despite traveling along the exact route dictated by the Israeli regime military, the two paramedics were instantly shot dead by the Zionist regime troops when they arrived on the scene. The bodies of Youssef Zaino and Ahmad al-Mahmoum were only found 2 weeks later, along with the bodies of Hend and her 6 relatives. Hend's mother, Wessam Hamda, says in the film that she never had any faith in international law in the first place. Hamda says, I never felt that international laws or international organizations
ever did anything for Gaza. It's just ink on paper. They didn't protect paramedics, journalists, children or civilians. And Lion, my uncle, his wife and children were executed in cold blood. Hence, killing caused outrage around the world. In April, student activists at Columbia University in New York renamed the building they occupied on campus, Hence Hall. The hip-hop artist Macklemore later released a song of the same name. Speaking to Al Jazeera, Nasreen Gawaz from the Palestine Red Crescent Society headquarters in Ramallah also released the trauma of that day. She says, "What makes it more difficult for me? Is it my only hand? Is there another 1,000 of hands story? 10,000 hands stories that did not have a name and the story on the TV, on the news, was not spread?" The Zionist regime's genocidal war against the population of the Gaza Strip has so far martyred more than 37,000 people since October 7, 2023, a number thought to be a significant underestimate due to the large number of bodies that remain trapped under the rubble. According to the film, by the end of 2023, more journalists and aid workers had been killed in Gaza than in any other conflict of the last few decades. Amnesty's Calamard has given similar warnings about the dire state of international law before. In April, she told Democracy Now! That the international system is on the brink of collapse due to the refusal by the US and others to hold the Zionist regime accountable for its crimes. And the night won't end. Al Jazeera journalist Sharif Abdul Qaddus also says that the Zionist regime's assault on Gaza has upended the system of international laws created since 1945. Amnesty's Calamard says the rules that were supposed to bind us together to prevent the worst from happening, those rules are no longer applicable. Everything we created after the Second World War, that's up for rewriting. And trust me, it will not just be the United States and their allies who are gonna do that. They have opened the door to hell.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Yemen launches a drone strike on Tel Aviv, leaving one person dead and several others injured. At least 50 Palestinians are killed in the latest Israeli airstrikes across Gaza, where the total death toll approaches 38,850. And the International Court of Justice says Israel's practices and policies in the occupied Palestinian territory are in violation of international law. Our top story for this half hour: Yemen has carried out a drone strike on Tel Aviv as part of its ongoing